Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. So just how bad can the climate get? We're going to continue the discussion caused by the latest New York Magazine cover story on climate change, titled The Uninhabitable Earth. Here with me now is its author, David Wallace Wells, deputy editor at New York Magazine, and Michael Oppenheimer, professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton. Thanks, both of you, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Same for me.
And listeners, did you catch the New York Magazine story on climate change? Are you one of those people Shumita was referring to who has had an anxiety spike as a result? Did it freak you out? Maybe you have questions for our guests, either the journalist or the scientist. Tweet at Brian Lehrer or call in 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And maybe, David, you should just say right up that this article was not a definite scenario. This is a worst case scenario article. That's what you did, right?
Absolutely. And I would say it's a very, very unlikely set of scenarios. I think that in order to get to some of the situations that I talked about, the planet would have to take absolutely no action on climate at all, which I think is basically impossible to imagine, and that the current science modeling for what would happen in that case would end up on this sort of far end of the bell curve beyond the median projections.
So why write an article like that?
Well, I've been a sort of close but amateur follower of climate news for a few years, and it struck me that the public seemed relatively well to understand what the scientists say is about the median likely outcome, about 2 degrees of Celsius of warming, which would probably result in some cities around the world being very heavily flooded and possibly drowned, and some other places being, made slightly uninhabitable in some other ways. But that seemed to form a kind of that seemed to be the outer limit of the way that the public imagined what was possible from climate change. And as a result, I think people weren't moving fast enough or taking seriously enough the threat. There's a whole 50% of outcomes beyond that median outcome. And it gets even worse if we don't take action. You look at, there were no climate change questions asked in the presidential debates. In the campaign, that was at best a third or fourth or fifth order policy priority. And it seems to me that if the public believed that some of these scarier scenarios were possible, which they are possible, though they're unlikely, that it would make all of our action on climate much more urgent.
So the article opens with lesser known consequences of melting Arctic permafrost. You write that the permafrost contains 1.1 trillion tons of carbon, more than twice as much as is currently suspended in the Earth's atmosphere altogether. Michael, do you want to weigh in on this as a scientist? What does that mean? People don't think about Arctic permafrost very much. So what is this scenario, and would that carbon completely flood the atmosphere if the permafrost melts quickly?
The permafrost contains a lot of carbon. It can be released into the atmosphere ultimately as carbon dioxide, the main human-made greenhouse gas, or as methane, a much stronger greenhouse gas. And there has been a concern percolating in the climate community for a long time that this release could happen relatively suddenly, and that means suddenly in geologic time, not tomorrow, but over the course of decades or centuries, and that could amplify the warming, creating what's called a positive feedback. We don't know how fast the release would be, but the balance of evidence at this point is that it would not happen quickly, but it would drag on as it occurred over the course of probably centuries. That means a significant addition to the warming, but not an earth-terminating contribution to the warming. But we're really not sure, and what David is doing is pointing out that this methane release possibility is one of several big changes that could occur that are not likely, but they're a risk. And since we only have one Earth to experiment on, we ought to know about those risks in order to minimize them.
And Dave, at this point, received some pushback, specifically from the noted climate scientist Michael Mann, who published a Facebook post in which he writes that he, quote, doesn't support the notion of a game-changing, planet-melting methane bomb.
Yeah, which neither do I. I use that detail in the piece to illustrate, as Michael just said, the sort of some of the wild card factors in our calculations about what's possible. And I do think that most scientists agree that this is a threat of some kind. They're unsure about, as Michael said, unsure about how quickly it will unfold. I think a few years ago, they seemed to be more concerned about a more sudden release, but that's new science has suggested that that's less worrisome. But what I would say to Michael Mann and a few other scientists who have picked up this issue is that none of the scenarios that I sketched out throughout the piece about how heat stress will affect life, or how warming will affect food production, or how it may affect conflict or economics are dependent on any additional methane release from permafrost at all. What I did was I took the UN's median projection for what is called the business as usual emission scenario, i.e. we don't do anything, and their high-end projections for what that would be. And I went to a number of scientists with specialties in subfields and asked, okay, what would that mean for food production? What would that mean for disease? What would that mean for heat stress on the body? And I also got a lot of information about those questions from academic papers published in many of the best journals. And on some level, I think of what the body of the story was as a kind of review of the literature on that subject. What is the best science that we have now about worst-case climate scenarios? Many of them are quite unlikely.
Can I add in here that I think if there is a problem with the story, it started with the framing. No scientist that I know of believe that the Earth will literally become uninhabitable due to climate change. That's number one. Number two, there were a few errors and some misleading statements. And I think that combination has caused David more trouble than the story deserved. I think that these issues need to get out there, that the public and policymakers need to hear about the possible extreme, although unlikely, outcomes, so they can make rational decisions. You have to remember that scientists have missed some of these in the past. Sea level is rising faster than expected, and the ice sheets are losing ice faster than expected 10 or 15 years ago. The ocean acidification process that's now widely recognized was just sort of overlooked by many scientists. The rapid loss of sea ice in the Arctic has happened much faster than expected. And this business about the wet bulb temperature, that certain areas of Earth could eventually become difficult to carry out normal outdoor activities, that's relatively recent. So scientists don't get all the big stories. They don't recognize the extreme risks all the time, and these extreme risks can manifest themselves. So to get them out there in a well-written story is important. It's just too bad that there are some errors here, and I hope David will fix up both the errors and the contextualization in some kind of follow-up.
We're talking about the New York Magazine cover story that this week getting discussed widely on worst-case scenarios of climate change with the author and deputy editor at New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells, and Michael Oppenheimer, professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton, and Jacob in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. Good morning. This is my question for more for Professor Oppenheimer, but I wanted to know your thoughts on geoengineering, if this is something that can really mitigate some of the bad effects of climate change. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you know what he's referring to specifically by geoengineering?
Yes. In general, it means manipulating the climate to offset the effects of warming, for instance, by launching particles which reflect sunlight. I myself am very dubious of it because of the potential unintended consequences. So I think it's an area that scientists need to do more research in, but I don't want to see anybody do any large-scale experiments in the atmosphere or any governments planning to oppose climate change by launching particles or anything like it. It's too risky.
Amy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I think one of the problems about communicating this to the public is that people tend to think in terms of like the dichotomy: this will happen, or it won't. It'll happen suddenly, and it's hard to get the concept across of, you know, that the consequences may be, you know, years or decades or more down the line. But you know, if we don't change our actions now, they're already set in motion.
It's a great point, David, that doomsday, quote unquote, doesn't happen in the environmental sense like a nuclear explosion. It happens drip, drip, drip.
Well, actually, that was one of the goals I had in writing the piece, was to illustrate that. As I said before, I think people have been really, the public has really been focused on a kind of median outcome and treating it as a worst case scenario. And, you know, things progress well beyond that, if especially if we don't take action quickly. You know, just to take one example, I talked in my piece about the work of Solomon Shang and Marshall Burke on conflict. And a lot of the science is quite speculative. I actually spoke about it with Michael before I published the piece. And, you know, it shouldn't necessarily be taken as gospel, but they estimate that for every half degree of warming, we see about a 10 to 20% increase in armed conflict. So even if we get to 2 or 3 degrees of warming, which is not just anything like a worst case scenario, it's, I would say, probably a likely scenario, that means you're dealing with as much as 60 or 120% more war. And again, these are estimates. These are very complicated algorithms to play through. And it's not as though we know that they're accurate even at the moment. But that would be absolutely crippling to our planet. And we should understand that those risks take effect. They're taking effect already because the planet is warming already.
Remember in the Democratic primaries when they went around, I guess it was one of the debates, and asked what's the biggest national security threat to the United States? And somebody said Iran, and somebody said Russia, and somebody said ISIS, and Bernie Sanders said global warming. And he was citing exactly this. Michael, do you want to go into the science of it a little bit more? But that research that David cites is that for every half degree of warming, societies see between a 10 and 20% increase in the likelihood of armed conflict. But a lot of listeners are going to hear that and go, what? For a half a degree of warming, you get a 20% increase in the likelihood of war? What's the relationship?
Well, there's speculation, but we don't know the mechanisms. But there are now a large number of statistical analyses of violent conflict of all kinds, from interpersonal conflict to people beating up on each other to major wars. And it's been studied on timescales ranging from days and months to centuries. And it turns out that there's a fairly robust statistical relationship that as things get warmer, conflict gets higher.
The most obvious, tell me if I'm wrong, is the desertification of places where water and therefore also food become more scarce because the desert expands, and then wars, like wars tend to be, are over resources.
That's one of the hypotheses. It makes sense. We know that environmental degradation, for instance, people can't make a living anymore out of agriculture. They start to move. They may move into areas that other people are trying to defend, and you get conflict. But though we don't have those connections nailed down yet, what we know for sure, what we think we know for sure at this point, is the hotter it gets, the more conflict is likely to ensue. But that doesn't mean there aren't ways to get it, to intervene, to prevent it, to reduce the risk. And that's what all this should be about. It shouldn't just be about fear. It should be about motivating us to both reduce emissions and to protect ourselves against the inevitable consequences that can't be avoided, which we hope will be a lot less than the worst case. We have to do both, and that really is, that's kind of why there's been such a kerfuffle about this. Some people would have written a different article. They would have written an article with a more positive spin. On the other hand, the negative spin is one that needs to be heard because it doesn't get heard enough. There are these really weighty outcomes which people haven't paid enough attention to in the popular literature.
Jessica in Los Angeles, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York, Jessica.
Hi, Brian. Hi. I'm a long-time listener, but I live in L.A. Yeah, I just wanted to say I watched Inconvenient Truth when I was 15 years old, and I got insane about climate change and recycling, and I kind of started a coalition in my neighborhood and everything, and because I grew up in Maryland. And, you know, now I avoid articles about climate change. I'm terrified about when I grow up and have a family and the earth is going to be so different. I mean, we're already seeing the changes, and I just need any bit of hope right now, really, to know that we're doing something that we can do can make a change.
Jessica wants to know something she can do, Michael.
Well, you know, the positive side of what's going on is that there's a revolution going on in the energy sector. We are perhaps on the verge of becoming a lot less dependent and eventually getting rid of the fossil fuels that are causing the problem, primarily coal, oil, and to a lesser extent natural gas, because the penetration of renewable energy, solar and wind power, are making it onto the grid. They're producing more and more of the U.S. and global electricity. And we could be at a social tipping point where we're just going to move away from fossil fuels. That's the positive side of it. All of that is not going to happen automatically, however. It means governments have to act, have to encourage these changes, have to disincentivize fossil fuels by, for instance, getting rid of subsidies. And you can help by getting out there and pushing the leaders.
Jessica, thanks, and please call us again from L.A. And Patricia in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm good. Just a brief comment to say that discussions about median and, you know, the average of what might happen, I think can become very dangerous. I don't believe there needs to be any correction or apology or softening of this article, because generally when people deny climate change, they don't have to apologize. So I feel like we need to scare people more into taking action as opposed to trying to water down or create positive images for people. But we also need to provide positive outcomes or things that we can do ourselves to help.
We also need to provide accuracy. So if there are mistakes in the article, they should be corrected. That doesn't mean that the big picture, you know, and the corrected version wouldn't still scare people. But David, what do you want to say to Patricia?
Well, I think that it is useful to think in terms of probabilities personally. And, you know, at some points in putting this story together, I did have some numbers in there. One problem is that really so many of those probability curves are so speculative that it's really hard to know what they mean. I've seen some estimates from some very reputable people that say there's about a 15% chance that we go over 6 degrees of warming. When I was interviewing Wally Broker, who's the man who coined the term global warming, he said that he felt that there was about a 10% chance that we go above 4 degrees. And there's a variety of models that you can use, but it's really hard to know at the moment how much to trust them. On the climate denial issue, you know, I'm sort of two minds about it. I mean, I do think that these scenarios that I sketched out are the best we understand worst case outcomes for climate change. I also understand that many of the scientists whose work I was working off of have spent their lives advocating for this cause and in certain ways doing battle with climate deniers and have become cautious in the way that they talk about their own work and its implications because they're worried about being criticized for making predictions that don't come true. I think that that's a legitimate concern. I personally happen to think that the public should be informed of the dangers that scientists understand, but I also am sympathetic to those who are reluctant to make a big fuss out of things that are quite unlikely.
That's interesting because some of the pushback to your New York Magazine cover story, this worst-case scenario of climate change article, was not necessarily from deniers, but from people, you know, in the activist community and some scientists saying nobody responds to doomsdayism, and people want to hear hopeful stories about solutions, and so that you risk doing more to further alienate the skeptics, and you know, make the politics even more difficult rather than easier when they're so difficult to begin with. You've heard that.
Can I make a comment on that? Just
of course.
A quick anecdote. I was at a meeting of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which advises governments on the science. And we were putting together a final report. And scientists had kind of put this business of the extreme heat, wet bulb temperature, areas where people couldn't survive doing normal outdoor activity on the back burner. They sort of buried it a little in the report. And one of the government people noted that and said, this should be a headline. This should be in the summary. This should be up front. And so it was moved there because the governments wanted it to be emphasized. Even though it wasn't something happening today, even though it's a risk that really is quite far in the future in some ways, the government said it's important for us to be pushed by those risks. So while fear might be immobilizing for some, it's true that these extreme cases have a value in educating us on what some of the dangerous possibilities are.
I'll take one more call. Corwin in Rego Park. You're on WNYC. Hi, Corwin.
Hey, how are you? Thank you very much for taking a call.
Sure. Thank you.
So I have a question whether the speaker there thinks that there's a responsibility for scientists to convince the general population. It seems like anybody who's heard this data, they've come to their conclusions, and the data keeps being presented in the exact same way every time. And it's not really addressing the fears and the concerns of the peoples who are skeptical. So is there this responsibility to convince?
Well, it's a great question for you, Michael, since you're a scientist. I mean, I know you have a long background in environmental activism, but in general, for climate scientists, as a group, is the responsibility, as you see it, to just present the data and let activists do their activist thing? Or should scientists be in the business of convincing the public about interpreting the data?
The scientist's first responsibility is to find the truth and to tell the truth. If individual scientists then feel compelled at a moral responsibility to try to help educate the public, as long as they do it within the constraints of telling the truth and not exaggerating, but telling it like they see it as scientists, then they should go out and do it. I don't think scientists should spend a lot of their time trying to scare the public, because I do think ultimately that's a mistake. But if the truth leads in the direction of getting the public anxious about a problem, well, maybe they ought to be anxious about a problem. So the first obligation, find the truth, tell it.
Do you think on the other side of that, that some climate scientists have been reluctant to publicize some of the uncertainties in the science, because all science includes uncertainties? That's, you know, the scientist's job is to identify degrees of uncertainty, just as this article identifies this as a set of worst-case scenarios for climate, but that scientists are getting afraid that by communicating the real uncertainties that they're going to be fueling the skeptics?
Yes, for sure. There are some scientists who, all of us, worry that if we're not careful with our language, that we'll just, you know, we'll somehow be proven wrong and give fuel to the skeptics. Others, some are very cautious. Others throw away the uncertainties, don't want to talk about them because they detract, in their minds, they detract from the fact that there is a real problem there. Right. And that's why I think what you should do is tell it straight. Don't try to spin it. Don't try to get into the public's head and figure out what they really need to hear. But tell the science as you know it. And then people who are experts on communication can figure out how to translate that effectively. And that's where good journalism comes in, so the public will get the full flavor of the message, but not in all the gory scientific detail, maybe.
Michael Oppenheimer, professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton, and David Wallace Wells, deputy editor at New York Magazine, and the author of this week's cover story being much shared and discussed, called The Uninhabitable Earth. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.